The Business Bunker with Paul Andrews.
Welcome back to the Business Bunker show here on channelradio.co.uk/2 in association with bizradio.co.uk on this Tuesday, the 16th of April, with me, Paul Andrews, and my co-host, the absolutely lovely
Bird on a Bike.
Bird on a Bike. Cool. Welcome back. We've got two great guests to talk to you in the second half of the show. We've got lots of things to cover. We've got tweets and we've got emails. But do tweet us if you'd like us to discuss a particular topic in our discussion forum.
Yeah, a scenario that you're debating or not. Or
yeah, yeah.
It's always good to be relative, isn't it, and relevant to the moment.
Yeah. The trouble is, I was saying off air earlier, we live in such weird times that there's almost nothing that you couldn't discuss that wouldn't, there's nothing. We're beyond shock now, the kind of stuff that's been going on, at all kinds of levels and in all kinds of ways, not just with Brexit, but...
Even you look at Debenhams, we got them going into administration.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And people you're not even surprised anymore now.
No, but... But the thing about that is you shouldn't be surprised. Why would a high street department store work in an era of the internet and shopping malls when local councils are taking out car parks and those that exist still cost 25 quid an hour to park in?
Yep.
Why would a department store in a town centre work? It just wouldn't. It makes no sense. And politicians jumping up and down going, save the high street, save the high street. Well, you killed it. Nobody else killed it. You killed it. Politicians killed it.
We had Sports Direct wanting to buy them out, didn't they?
Hmm.
And that didn't go through.
Yeah. But,
why?
Why would you do that?
Why? Yeah.
That's just property speculation, really, isn't it? Yeah, no, it's a shame. It's a shame from Debenham's point of view, and it can have... big ramifications on both Ashford and Canterbury that both have Debenham stores in them. But there you go. But
you look at you had Tesco's. Did you watch that programme the other day about Tesco's?
No, I heard
100 years
it,
of Tesco's. Really interesting. I said to Stephen, I said, that's to celebrate something in itself, how a business has gone for 100 years.
Yeah, it's unusual.
It's really unusual, isn't it? How he's gone from a market stall to this biggest landowner in the UK. Let's be really honest. And now they're saying, well, where are they going to go with this? Because they've now brought out Jack's and, and it's like, well, maybe it is that end of, we were talking about it, weren't we?
Yeah.
David, about the end of the life of that business.
Yeah. People don't ever appreciate this. Things go in cycles. Things boom and bust. Things rise and fall. Otherwise we would still have, people making cannonballs for the Royal Navy. It things fade away. I'll tell you, this is true. I looked this up. The year I was born, 1955, okay, the FTSE 100, only 12 of those companies still exist.
Wow.
If we're business owners, we're all passionate about it. We've worked ridiculously hard. We've put a lot of investment in time and money and emotion, in commitment, in disagreements with everybody around you.
Yeah.
When is it time to say, okay, this is the end of the life of the business?
Mm-hmm.
And we were just talking about it, this is how I'm feeling. What should you do? Should I not? What do we do as business owners?
The thing is, there's so many answers to that, isn't there? I mean, the fact is, it all depends on what you want to do and what the structure of your business is and where you are. If you're a big public company, then what tends to happen is, even if you go into administration, is someone will buy the remnants of your business and then strip out the bits that are useful and get rid of the bits that aren't, yeah? And quite often, a name will survive, even though it bears no relationship to what you do anymore, because it's a strong brand that people know. And sometimes people park that to use it in a later date as something else. What happens to most big businesses is they don't die per se by going bust. They get absorbed. Yeah. So basically their market runs out, or they're not as powerful as they used to be, or, their products are no longer in the demand that they were, and someone will take them over and strip out the assets of it. And that's what normally happens. And if you look back to what I just said about the FTSE 100, the 82 companies that disappeared, most of them actually didn't go bust. They just got taken over and faded out. They just aren't there anymore, because things change. Technology changes, things change, and sometimes the brand associated with a technology just doesn't work anymore. And therefore you have to let it go.
And is it as simple as that, do you think, that it is literally just let it go? The idea, all that investment, you've just got to go, this is the end of the line with it.
There's, unless you radically reinvent yourself, in a completely new product line, which you can do and which you should do. I mean, that's what you have to do.
Is give us an example. Who's done that, do you think?
Very few people have done that, but I'll give you one example. I'll give you one example, and this took huge, huge, huge dangly bits of steel to do this. Computer Weekly, which was a trade magazine through the 70s and 80s, had one competitive magazine. There was Computing and Computer Weekly. There was just two weekly trade magazines. And back in the day, if you wanted to advertise a job in Computer Weekly, it cost an absolute arm and a leg. I once took a four-page advert, which cost me £45,000. Yeah? £45,000 for a page in Computer Weekly. Long before the proverbial hit the fan, the people that owned Computer Weekly sat there and went, do you know what? In a few years' time, we're not going to be able to get away with this. We need to reposition ourselves. So they took the whole thing online and went from 45 grand an ad to £200 an ad. That took huge names of steel. However, they're the only organisation left. All the others went bust. Because they just got faded out of the market, and Computer Weekly still exists, and they still make their income from online advertising, not printed advertising. They don't carry printed advertising in. They still produce paper, but it's no, you know, the printed advertising just points you to the website.
So was that luck? Was that looking at the marketplace and going, look, this isn't going to work anymore?
It's there's two things. It was strategic analysis, but anyone can do that. To some extent, you can look at the market and go, this ain't going to work, you know, or things are going to change. But to actually destroy a business that was working in order to back that change takes enormous courage.
How do you get that past the, how do you get that past the shareholders and things? How do you go, oh, by the way, we're going to lose money for X amount?
Yeah.
How do you get that past them?
That's why most companies go bust, because the shareholders and the owners of businesses won't let go of the banana. Yeah, it's like a monkey with his hand on a banana outside the cage. They won't let go of the banana. That's why they go bust, because they won't have that courage to reinvent themselves. Mm-hmm. It's tough. I'm not slagging anybody. It is amazingly tough to let go of something that's working, because your rationale goes, well, maybe it will pick up next year.
Yeah.
Or maybe it will pick up next year. Or it's not quite as bad. You know, we're still in business. And we're still in business, and we're still in business. Oh, no, we're not in business.
Hang on, we're hanging on.
And that's the problem, isn't it? You just can't tell. And also, of course, the other problem is the winners always get to tell the story. So I just told the story of Computer Weekly, who won by doing that. Mm. I didn't tell you the story of all the people that made a similar judgment and then lost.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's the issue, isn't it? Is if you're one of the losers, you just fade into obscurity and nobody knows.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And there's more losers than the winners always. Mm. But, you know, there's a macro level to all of this as well. You know, businesses fade and go. You know, we're talking about the potential demise of Debenhams in Ashford Town Centre. At the same time, Netflix are talking about putting their European headquarters here. Yeah. So, you know, on the one hand, you lose some things, and on the other hand, something new comes along.
Yeah, you change.
And always something new comes along. I had this argument with a chap who's very scared about artificial intelligence and the fact that we're all going to die and nobody's going to have a job. Well, I'm old enough to remember the start of the computer revolution when they said exactly the same thing. And during the 60s and 70s, all of our old smokestack industries went, you know, first shipbuilding, then the coal mines, then car plants. Everybody started collapsing and we all went, we're all going to die. Except we didn't. What happened is we reinvented stuff. During the 1970s, we lost 350,000 industrial jobs in the UK and created 4.5 million new ones in technology. Yeah. In 1970, when I started working computing, there were only two jobs you could do, a computer operator and a computer programmer. Now, in 2019, there are over 700 different jobs you can do in IT and digital. And it's one of the biggest employers in the country. There are 600,000 people shortage of digital people in the UK. So it swings and roundabouts. Mm. And the whole point about business is you can't keep going with an original business idea. It's really difficult. you see some companies, you know, like there's butcher shops that are 300 years old and been in the family, you know, but they're not very big. There's just one shop and they just manage to hang on to it as a lifestyle business, or like a cobbler's shop. Or, do you know what I mean? There are specialist businesses that can hang in there against all the odds, but a bigger business just can't do that. It's not sustainable.
Okay, let's be really radical here then. So if you've got, let's say, about all this technology and all these jobs that have been created over the last probably 10 years, if we're really realistic about it, isn't it? Teaching people how to use online stuff, what they're going to do. So we've now got a generation growing up that are using an iPad before they can barely walk.
Spill their rusks
so
on it.
How long does that have a lifespan? Because if you're growing up with it as just day-to-day technology, what you use, you grow up, you go to school, you learn all this stuff. I'm not knocking anybody's business. How long before that becomes the everybody needs to do this, but actually everybody knows how to do it anyway? Because it is probably one of those jobs that, you know, we didn't grow up with it. We've learnt to muddle our way through
If you think about it, it's a really good point, that, Nettie. And if you think about it, if you look at it historically... Okay, back in the Middle Ages, the only people that could read and write were monks, fairly much, yeah? So therefore, they controlled the means of communication. It took years to write a book, and it was a book, yeah? Yep.
Taken me years to write a book, I tell you.
But there's our pretty pictures in them. Once Gutenberg invented the removable type, and we started to be able to print, and then people were taught to read and write, it effectively did away with the monastery approach to producing books. But by the same token, it then opened up markets that were unthought of before, you know, polemic newsletters, books, pamphlets, all kinds of things. And as everybody in the West came to be able to read and write, it became a no-brainer anymore. So once upon a time, it was a really esoteric skill. Now it's a skill that everybody possesses. It's the same with technology. Once upon a time, the people that could code, or the people that could develop a website, or people that knew how to use digital technology, like me back in the day, were ivory tower people. You know, we'd all go, "Whoa, we know something that none of you know."
Yeah.
Yeah. And I earned a lot of money, a lot of money as a techie when nobody else had technical skills. Now, my grandson, who's 9 months old, knows more about technology than I do. Yeah.
And that's my point. Yeah. It's changing a
bit. Yeah, absolutely. But the fact is, then it becomes a base level, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And what really annoys me are schools that keep saying, we ought to ban iPads and phones. And you go, oh, yeah.
Why?
I tell you what, let's ban books. Let's ban reading and writing. Let's ban pens.
Ban the children from going.
Yeah. Because it is blatantly ridiculous.
Yeah.
If you live in a world that's digital, why wouldn't you use digital techniques to do things? Yeah.
But we know why they're doing it.
Yeah. But
we know why, because they don't have the behaviour to support. That's the problem.
Exactly. It's the teaching,
so it's
that's the problem.
It's not the technology you need to take away. You need to influence and support and inspire people to behave in a respectful, kind, amazing manner. That's the difference.
Yeah.
It's not the technology that's creating the bad behaviour.
Absolutely. But if you look at history, that's exactly the reapproach we had take to everything. When a new technology comes along, our government are doing it right at this moment. They're trying to ban the internet. They are trying desperately hard to ban... No, they are. They are desperately trying hard to ban the internet. We have the most severest internet regulations in the world, except for North Korea, in this country. And it's insane. Yeah. And it is typical of what people do when they see a problem like this. Rather than change the infrastructure, they try to ban it. They try to stop it. They try to stop it rolling out. And you will never stop it. What you have to do is integrate it, because that's your future. And you're absolutely right, Nettie. Future generations, Generation Z, the generation now coming into the workforce, all have digital skills.
They do.
And they have those. When you talk to them, you go, do you want to work in digital? And they go, no.
No.
Why would you? It's like asking someone that can read and write, do you want to be a scribe? No, why would I want to be
why
a scribe?
Yeah.
I can just read and write. It's as basic as that. It becomes a fundamental platform on which you do things. It's nothing special about it. It's what you do.
Yeah. So unless you can completely stand up in that industry and you've got such a niche that no one else has thought of, like loads of things, it's got a shelf life again, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But what it is, it's using those technical skills to develop new things.
Yeah.
So at the moment, the big thing is fintech. and financial technology. We're founding one fintech company every 50 seconds in the UK at the moment. The UK is the world leader in fintech. We have two unicorn businesses. A unicorn business is a startup valued at $1 billion. We have two unicorn businesses in the UK that are both fintech companies. We're creating new technologies all the time, you know, Monzo card, coconut card, stuff like that. All of that is happening, all of it under the radar. People don't see it happening. They just go, oh, you know, so-and-so, Debenhams is going bust. Yeah. We're all going to die.
Yeah. Yeah. Brexit's been delayed. Oh, sorry, we don't use the B word. Mm.
But it's, you know, it is a shame for the people, the owners, the shareholders, the management, the staff, the customers of someone like Debenhams. It's a massive shame and there are massive issues. You know, I'm not trying to write off the fact that you need to help them.
No.
But at a macro level, it's just a natural order of things where things come and go.
It's the way it should be.
Yeah.
We were talking about this last week, weren't we, David, with some other colleagues, but about there was a thing, wasn't there, last week about certain people when you mail order stuff are going to start fining or blacklisting people who order stuff and take it back.
Yeah.
Right, so it's generally ladies and it's generally clothes.
Mm.
But why would you take one item into a changing room if you're in a shop and think, I'll try this on, oh, this doesn't fit, I'll put it back on the rack and go home. You take a pile in, you choose what you want and you buy those. It's the same philosophy, just doing it, buying it online and sending it back. It's no different.
Yeah.
So again, they're not thinking about that is the process. They're thinking this is costing us money. So instead of looking for why people are doing it or coming up with some amazing system where you can have so many for 30 quid a year or whatever it might be, they're trying to ban people from buying from them because they don't buy everything they send them. Where's the logic?
You get this skewed idea of what's going on because you don't pay attention to your customers.
Exactly.
It's like a certain delivery company who I won't name, Hermes.
Beautiful perfume. It's one of my favourite perfumes,
actually. Really nice.
I ordered something for Amanda's birthday, and I ordered it 9 weeks before her birthday.
Is this what you told her?
Yeah.
Okay, stick to the story.
Yeah.
Stick to the story.
9 weeks before her birthday. The weekend of her birthday was when they were going to deliver it. It shouldn't have taken 9 weeks. Anyway, her birthday was on the Sunday. I get a text saying, your parcel will be delivered on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
You just bet. I get a text at 4 a.m. Sunday morning. We tried to deliver your parcel at 3 a.m. There was no one in. Yes, there was. We were all sodding sound asleep. Yeah. And no, they didn't try to deliver my parcel at 3 a.m. My CCTV was completely empty. No one came up my drive at 3 a.m. No one was working at 3 a.m. Yeah. It was complete nonsense. And there was no car through my door. But you see, they waste their time and they waste their journeys with their silly no reply emails and no, we're not paying attention to you.
Yeah.
And that's when you start to hit those problems where they make judgments based on this is hurting us without thinking about, well, why did a customer do this?
Yeah. Exactly that.
How can we avoid this, or how can we make a business out of this?
Mm.
You know, how can we get customers that buy things online to be able to try things online before they buy them?
Yeah.
You know, how do we do that?
You have a shop in the high street.
Exactly. Yeah.
But sometimes you can't because it's human behaviour.
Yeah.
And there's patterns to behaviour and it's predictable and we never change.
Yeah.
So there are patterns. This is what we're showing now. So the horse came, you know, that you bought 10,000 horses the next day, Ford car arrives.
Yeah.
You know, the computers, it's all the same.
Yeah, yeah.
They're cycles of behaviour.
Yeah.
Just look at behaviour of people and that will show you the next thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And sometimes you just have to build things in. If people are going to return clothes that don't fit, they're going to return clothes that don't fit. What
but
you have to do is price it in.
But this is the miracle of knowing what women want, isn't it?
Mm.
Cool. Which is a simple answer every
time. I don't get it, Natty.
I don't get it either.
So that's it.
We're not exactly complicated.
Women do that,
creatures.
Though. That's how women buy.
Yeah.
And they go in and they send stuff back or they would wear it. And then there's this big complaint about, oh, is this what's happening? It's always happened.
Yeah.
It always will.
Yeah.
It's just in a different platform.
Exactly.
I'm going to read a couple of quick tweets and then we're going to talk to our guests. I think, because we're fast running out of time here. Oasis have been on Vanilla Web, Bird on a Bike. Looking forward to the show today. Alexi Consulting, Oregon Training and Pegasus Software will be discussing productivity in the construction industry on the 2nd of May at the London Golf Club. It's a completely free event. You can book your place by going to Oasis oasis.co.uk, o-a-sys.co.uk. Go to their website and book your place at the London Golf Club on the 2nd of May for a productivity discussion, primarily in the construction industry. And I've also had a tweet from the lovely folks at Telcare. We're checking out what's happening in Kent business community. We're tuned into the Business Bunker show with Vanilla Webb and Bird on a Bike. So thank you to the lovely folks at Telcare, who are the telecoms company based over there on the Medway City Estate at Rochester. Thank you for that. So let's talk to Nettie. Oh, no, sorry. Oh, I must read this one. I'll get in trouble. It's from Venues and Events Expo. Hi, Vanilla Web. Hi, Bird on a Bike, Business Bunker. We're working hard on this year's Vexpo 19, which is just 4 weeks away. Please, can you shout out to business owners who would like to find a new venue for a meeting, event, or an away day? You can register for free here. Venueseventsexpo.co.uk. Check it out. I'll be there.
Good.
Yeah. So, Nettie.
Hiya.
Hiya. Lovely to see you again.
Angie.
Annette Bunn from Rift Accounting. And Annette has brought us a guest. Why don't you introduce your guest?
I always bring you a guest.
You always bring me a guest, and you bring me really interesting, good guests. Yes.
This one's a very quiet, reserved person.
I noticed.
Got to be really,
I know. We're going to have to get him out of his shell, aren't we?
We are somehow. Yeah.
Good luck.
So I've brought David Day along today. Mm. David's an architect, works on all sorts of things. He will modestly not tell you that he's won awards and all sorts of things for some of the amazing things that he's come up with. And David and I have known each other probably not that long, actually. Although we do remember when we first met. We probably shouldn't discuss that too much.
Was it a Captain Scarlet reunion party?
It was. We first met at a networking event, which we could honestly say, I won't say where it was or who chaired it, but it was pretty bad, wasn't it?
And we both stood there on the outskirts looking in.
thinking, why am I here? And that's the first time we ever spoke. Brandon, we had something in common, which was that we should have just gone straight home. And since then, we've sort of, our paths have crossed, and then crossed a lot more in the last year or so David's a client and so on and so forth now. But I'll let him talk about what he does, and then we can talk more about how we know each other.
Yeah. So, David, you're an architectural designer.
Got a practice over in Kingsnorth. Been there 15 years, designing extensions, new builds. Just been sitting, plugging away at this over the years. Really enjoy what I do. And it's just been always looking for the next big thing to come along.
Right.
And, the industry is always evolving. And, new regulations come in. We're just going through the end of the phase now where a lot of the permitted development rights, they relaxed all the regulations to get the building industry going. Well, they all end at the end of May, so there's now a rush for people to get oversized buildings in, completed and signed off before the end of May. You've got people that are living next to these people that have done that process. They're saying, well, I can't get it done by them. You're not going to get it built. So you're kind of managing expectations. So you're not just helping people realize a dream extending or whatever, but you're also looking at them. You're managing the expectation, which sometimes can be challenging.
I can imagine. Funnily enough, I had an extension built on my house 2 years ago. I didn't need an extension built on my house. I got into one of these frames of mind where I sat there and I thought, you know what, I might move. But at the time, I was living on my own in a rather large house. And I thought, this is stupid. It did save me money because I didn't bother to clean. I just moved rooms.
Yeah.
And I started to look at the possibility of moving. And the cost of moving was like 55,000 quid by the time you paid your stamp duties and everything else. And I thought, I could build an extension for that.
Yeah.
And this is where...
And that's where you come in, because you have to go out. People say, can you go out and have it? Can you tell me this? Can I do this? I need to see it, and I need to see it in the context of where you are. And I mean, it's no good. You've got a nice little chocolate box cottage and you want to put a big glass tower on the back. Not going to happen. And likewise, I've had people before, oh, well, I've got a flat. Can I extend that?
Yeah, of course you can. Yeah.
So it does happen. You do get people. The other people you get is that move into a new estate. And the first thing they want to do is they want to extend the house. You've just moved. You've got to move to, you just don't understand some people sometimes. So that's quite interesting. But as I say, it's just all about, you've got things that come in, design changes come in. You've got, the worst call ever is on a Thursday morning, I was watching Grand Designs last night. I've seen this, and you're like, oh no, please, no.
Yeah.
I mean, that's led to like big thing with bifold doors. I want bifold doors. I want bifold doors. Flat roofed extensions.
Mm.
You're trying to get away from people putting boxes on houses to something a bit more elaborate, more fancy, a bit more contemporary. But sometimes it doesn't work. But
did you go through the phase of people wanting to build a cellar?
Yeah,
that was a big one in London, wasn't it? It was building downwards.
I worked for a company. I did some subcontracted to a company that did those, and we did a system where you bought one house and then you got six houses either side.
Mm.
So you went in one house and then you dug out underneath them, and the people still lived in upstairs.
Mm.
It was just frightened me. But it was all, and the architect that was doing those, he went no more than 10 streets. His radius was 10 streets. That was his patch.
Right.
And he was doing most of the extensions in that area.
Right.
Interesting to see doing, but sometimes you just think, no, it's not going to work.
it's kind of scary, isn't it? Because you kind of think, blimey, I wonder if some point in the future we're all going to collapse into
<Yeah.
laughs>
their basement.
You do hear a story. You do see them every now and again in the press where they've gone in, and you just think, oh, I wouldn't like to be the architect on that one.
Mm.
And then the other thing you get is people that have got a nice house and then want the kitchen dug up to put a wine cellar in. Now, that's a good...
Mm.
That's so you get the big spiral things that go in.
Yeah.
They're interesting to do.
Right, okay. Yeah. So as an architectural designer, you do mostly domestic, or is it a mixture?
It's mainly domestic, some residential, and commercial. So you've got the element of commercial, but it is mainly the domestic market. But I've done a bit of all sorts. I mean, done listed buildings, another area that I work in as well. Mm. So I think the oldest property I worked on, done a little bit of work on St Paul's Cathedral many, many years ago.
Well, okay.
So, and then the biggest bit project I worked on in London was part of a team. We was on the Gherkin.
Right, okay.
Working there, that was for an interiors company.
Hmm.
And back in the day was the structural steelwork or some support work right at the top of the Lloyd's building.
Right, okay.
Where it's got all the services on the outside. So it's been quite a varied career and varied sorts of buildings, but mainly I do sort of 60% residential and then another 40%, the rest of it is all bits and pieces, really.
So yeah, okay. So in the residential field, is there a particular, you know, we've talked about, you know, building downwards, we've talked about flat roof extensions, and the big one at the moment is these bloody... Sorry. These glass buildings that people are all into at the moment.
Yeah. There seems to be a... It's really hard to define what people want. You've got to go and see, and you always got to get to people. You've got to have an idea of what you want and what you want to achieve for the house. It's no good me designing something that's good for me when I don't have to live with it. Mm. So I'm looking at a house at the moment, and we're actually building an extension at first floor.
Right.
Because they're happy with the layout downstairs. They just need to change it upstairs. So we've come up with a system, and I've done it on a couple of houses. Then this one goes over a driveway, so we're forming a carport. So it becomes all sorts of...
Yeah.
So we've done a couple of those, and they're just something a bit different. And you put them into the planning offices, and they come straight back to you. We like this. This is just that little bit of thinking out of the box. It's rather than a two-story extension. And it's cheaper for the client. The client gets what they want, and they also get something that's just that little bit different, which when they go to sell the property, and I always say to people, you've got to look at it, design it for you, but you've got to design it that it's desirable for when you sell the property on.
Yeah.
And sometimes some people have ideas, I can make two little skinny rooms. That's no good to anybody. You'll never sell it.
Mm.
And so it is this guiding people and trying to explain to people. And the other thing you don't want to do is over-design it, that you price yourself out the street. So you're kind of, you've got your eye on all these different things to pull it together. And it's never as easy as, how much will it be? How much does it cost? Well, I need to see it, and then I can base everything around that and then customise that design for you.
Mm. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth or denigrate your clients, but do you see quite a few people that come away with the grand design? Kind of, I'm back to thinking about garden rooms. Garden rooms, these glass things are all a bit, and you can actually buy them as pre-made kind of structures now as well, can't you?
Yeah.
And I look at those and I think they look really nice in the pictures, but I got a house, for instance, surrounded by trees, and if I put a glass anything there, within about 3 months everything's green.
That's what you try to get explained to you. You get them to tell you what they want, then you can look at it, and experience over the years tells you, well, this won't work.
Mm.
and you can gradually guide people. Some people are adamant, this is what I want to do, and those will, but some people, they will take on board your comments, you take on board your ideas, and from that, you come something in between.
Yeah.
But it's all finished, that's the best thing. When it's all finished, then you look at it and you go, that is how I imagined it. And they're looking at it going, that is better than I imagined. That is the best bit.
Well, to be honest, that happened with my extension, because I just had the idea of my house. I needed a bigger kitchen. The kitchen I had was fine, but it was out of context with the rest of the house. Yeah. To make it a family house, you needed a bit of kitchen and stuff like that. So my idea was just to build a bit more on the back where I had the room to do it. And the guy that designed mine went, you don't want to do that. You want to make it much bigger than that.
Yeah. Okay.
You're just trying to get me to spend more money. He went, no, seriously. Yeah, because you're doing the work anyway, you'd be better off doing it like this. And I went with his ideas, and he was absolutely right. You know, it was the best thing I ever did, was to let him do it bigger than it was. Funnily enough, I don't know the exact ins and outs of this, but I could dig it out. When we put in for the planning permission, in fact, the planners went, do you know what? It needs to be another 2 metres further out.
Yeah.
You're telling me to build it bigger? And I went, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes they work with you, and they're saying to you, look, it's all about proportion.
Yeah.
I've got a case going through at the moment, and it's too big.
Mm.
So I'm trying to get the client to scale it down.
Mm.
And there's been some resistance there. They're not in this area.
Mm.
And it's just, but I've come up with a scheme, put it into them, and they're like, yeah, I like that. Mm. Planners will accept that. So you can win these things back round.
Yeah.
Are you feel that your business, really, I would imagine the planning, and forgive me if I've got this wrong, is trying to keep you in, they don't want it to be too futuristic. You're balancing between keeping it the same and trying to move things forward.
You're trying to move things forward all the time. You're always trying to just push that envelope a little bit more. Planners are always looking for change, bit of initiative shown. They just don't want boxes and boxes and boxes on backs of houses. They want to see a bit of flair to it.
They do want change.
Oh, they do want change, but it's sometimes the change has to be on their terms.
Yeah.
And you might go too far.
So subjective,
right? Yeah. But
where's the egos there?
Yeah.
But it is they do work with you. You know, there is, you know, at the moment planning is a really contentious thing. There's all sorts of issues.
Always has been though, hasn't it?
I think there's all sorts of, there's so much going on at the moment that there's people disappear. The planners are going to work for the contractors. So the experience, and it's just, it's the processes, it's getting better now, much better. Mm. But you've got planners in there that are new, and they're like, oh, we can make our mark. You've got the old planners in there. Oh, I just want, it's who you get.
I always say this to Paul. We complain about politics and everything. Mm. And I say, look, we can't really complain about it unless you're prepared to go into the arena.
Yeah.
Mm. Would you ever think about becoming a planner so that you could have more of an impact in the community?
Well, I've got that impact in the community because I'm designing. Mm. So I'm submitting these things. So that's where, I mean, it was what we were talking about when we first came in. The design, my work is all around you. Architect's work, designer's work is around you. Everywhere you look, that was designed. This was on that table. This room was designed. It was drawn somewhere.
Mm.
And there was an influence that's gone into it. There's also regulations that you've got to put into it. It's not just a case of drawing a pretty picture and building it. It's how do you build it? And sometimes that's where some architects, like you see the bigger structures in London.
Mm. And nowadays, of course, there's also this element of sustainability and eco-friendliness that you try to build into your buildings, presumably.
Yeah. Well, that kind of leads on. This talks into the way we were talking about business and how it all runs.
Mm.
I've been working with carbon neutral builders for the last 18 months, and I've just gone on board with them as a consultant. And that is a polystyrene carbon neutral building made out of polystyrene, backfilled with concrete. The advantages of it, once you see the system and it's explained to you.
I'm trying to conceptualise how you build a house out of polystyrene.
Me too.
We can bring them in. They will bring them in.
It's basically a block, a metre long, 350 mil wide. And
is it a hollow block?
It's 150 mil of a graphite type polystyrene.
Yeah.
It's got 150 mil cavity backfilled with concrete, and then a 50 mil polystyrene on the inside, bars across the middle of it, all that polystyrene. So that's the equivalent of 12 facing bricks.
Right.
And that just literally clicks together.
Right, so you set it all by Lego.
It's similar to Lego in a way. And we can get a two-story house up, three-bed house
And what's the advantage of building it from polystyrene blocks?
It's carbon neutral.
Yeah.
It's you put all the technologies into it. It's cheaper to build.
Mm.
So it's 70% cheaper
Wow.
on the build, on the materials.
Yeah.
But the advantages you've got is that once you put the technologies in, it triple glazed windows, you put solar PV panels on it, you put your air recovery system in there, it runs itself.
Yeah. Right.
So they're 70% cheaper to run for household bills. So the, the build cost will come out more or less the same to a traditional build, but the moment you start using it, it's...
Your running costs are cheaper.
Running costs itself. Yeah, so even you sitting in the room, you're generating heat that's going to be recovered to turn into heat. And it just...
Mm.
You've got the solar panels on the top. We've got a development built with it, and the guy's running his electric car with solar panels.
So you can get off the grid?
You can get... You almost get off the grid.
That's so interesting, isn't it?
My mate Raj, from my local Indian takeaway, we've got self-heating houses.
Mm.
Yeah, he supplies the fuel. I heat the house.
She's thinking.
Mm.
But that's where
the future's going now, because as we say, rules and regs change, and 5 years time it's all new builds, there'll be no gas boilers in there, they're coming out, so we're getting to ahead of that curve now. This goes back to what we were saying about the high street. Everything changes. There's a change coming. It's been creeping up on us for a very long time.
Yeah. It just doesn't come out of nowhere, does it?
No.
And it's been coming, but nobody's really paid attention. There's people like this, the company I'm with, Creo. They've been working at this. He's been working at 15 years, developing this thing. And it's got to the stage now where it's creeping out. And it's like, we're going to go with it now.
Mm.
And it's just this wave is going to come as people wake up to it.
It's interesting, isn't it? And again, but you see where political decisions start to have ramifications. They're talking about eventually banning gas boilers. Mm. That means that you're left with only two or three other forms of heating. And the most likely is electricity.
Electricity.
But how on earth are we going to generate all that electricity?
Well, because there's no coal.
Yeah.
There'll be no coal-powered electricity. There's nuclears.
They won't build nuclear power stations.
There's only so much wind.
Yeah.
So it goes back to solar, then it comes back to wood. Houses will incorporate it in.
Yeah, so what interests me is the only real way forward, especially in rural areas, is to generate your own electricity.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I think a lot of the future will be, is in generating your own electricity, whether you've got your own windmill, solar panels, whether you use...
Ground source heat pumps.
Ground source, you've got air. This one works on air. So it's basically no bigger than an air conditioning unit that's parked outside. And it's just, there's no radiators.
Yeah.
You've got more wall space. You can have as much, because it's triple glazed, it's soundproofed, it's quiet.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's the future. I'll have a flying car next year.
For Destiny or Melody.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got a heat pump that heats my swimming pool outside, which is hilarious, this heat pump, when you see it running. In the middle of the summer, it has a little snow cloud over the top. Literally, it snows over the top of it, where it's thrown out so much cold air. Fascinating technology. Of course, all of that's great when you're talking about new stuff. But here in Kent, we've got loads of host houses. Yeah. We've got loads of barns.
Because there's been rules and regs changed on barns. You had the Park Q or Document Q, redundant farm buildings, disused farm buildings. So there's an opportunity now to go in, and it's very strict to get it. It's only 30% of all applicants actually get through.
Mm.
And the precept is you have to keep the concrete frame or the steel frame within the building.
Mm.
And we're just doing one at the moment at Edgerton. Mm. And that, it's just a real... The site was interesting because the way the barn was constructed, but you have to keep the structure in there.
Mm.
And we've done that out of the Creo block.
Right.
And so there's those opportunities. And then you've got the listed buildings. Again, that's another whole different ballpark.
Sure.
And then, but you're stuck with that because you've got to work with the conservation officers. So you can't put new technologies in there. So you've got to find the craftsmen that can work on those. So it's an interesting time trying to find all these people. So.
Bats. Bats.
Oh, yeah.
I had a house where I had a loft full of bats. That was hilarious.
Yeah.
I
grew up in a house where Batman used to come and visit.
Yeah.
For a few years, sort the bats out. Yeah.
Do you know what, though? I've always had this dream of living in an industrial building.
Mm.
You know, like an old water pumping station or even a warehouse, something like that. I've always had this dream of having a house made out of an industrial building. I don't know why. I don't know where it came from. I think it's a kind of fall. Years ago, I lived in New York and I rented a loft. Yeah. And I loved that. It was brilliant. And, what are you looking at me like that?
I never knew you lived in New York.
I've lived in the US a couple of times.
Check you out.
I've lived in New York for 5 or 6 days. And then I came home.
Before that, I lived in Pittsburgh for a while and also in Connecticut. Just, you know, working there. Funnily enough, when I lived in Connecticut, I actually worked for a nuclear engineering company, the one that built Three Mile Island, as it happened. Fascinating things, buildings, especially in a rural county like Kent, where you've got this whole range of listed buildings, converted buildings like house houses and farm buildings and barns and stuff like that, and then new builds as well. I live in the country on a main road. And somebody's just got planning permission to build 30 houses next door to me. I don't have any neighbours at the moment at all. That's going to be a laugh.
Yeah.
I can't wait for them to start building when they discover that they've actually bought a swamp to build on. Because there are 3 underground rivers that run across the piece of ground that they bought. And I don't know if they know that. But it's going to be a hell of a job to actually build on that unless they put some heavy-duty piling down. But there you go. So it's a fascinating subject, David, and from you personally, we haven't got much time now, but from you personally, what's the bit that excites you personally? What's the bit that makes you get up in the morning and go, I love being an architectural designer, me, because I can do, you know, the twiddly bits? It's like a bit like the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
You've got that flexibility. You can sit there and I can kind of got to a stage now, I can pick and choose the projects I want to work on. Yeah. So I find something, and it might not be the project, it might be the people I'm working for.
Right, okay.
And that's always important as well. You've got to work the people you're doing the job for, you've got to get on with, and you've got to work with them.
Mm.
And sometimes I've taken projects and I've worked with the people purely because they're really nice.
Yeah.
And it's not the most exciting project, but it just, and you know when you hand it over, it's good. But it's just always that next project, it's that next challenge.
Yeah.
And it's just a rule change. Can I push it? Can I push the envelope and get that one through? So that's what the challenge is.
Do you find yourself coming in and saving people who thought they could do it themselves?
Yeah.
And then they've needed you to come in because we do think that we can do it ourselves. So it's fine. Yeah. I don't need this professional help. And actually, that's exactly what we do need, is that support and guidance. Through.
Yeah, I've done that a few times now, that people have steamed ahead with it and then got to a point where they've just gone, I don't understand the process.
Yeah,
and you're like, all right, what have you done? Okay, push that to one side. Mm. Let's sort this out. And then you can recover the project. That's always a nice feeling as well. When you get that, when you get the application granted, you got that email that comes through and you just think, yeah, that was a job well done.
Mm.
And you phone the client up and the relief in their voice is, oh, you got it passed, thank goodness. We didn't think we were going to get it. We thought we'd mucked it up. No.
Well, our homes are so important. It sounds so obvious, but it is the most important thing,
isn't it?
That's
what I always say to people. It's really personal. Whatever I do to your house, whatever you do is personal to you. I might not like it, but to you, it's what you want.
Mm.
And it's all about the client thing again, client satisfaction. It's getting that over to someone. You can have what you want, but these are the parameters you've got to work within. And once you've done that...
I've got to ask you this question because I just saw how animated you were. Have you ever done a job where a client has gone, I want this, and you've gone, okay, and you've built it. And when you've built it exactly as they want it, they go, I don't like that.
I've been really lucky in that I've not, but I know a couple of architects that have had that happen and they've gone, we really don't like it. And I'm like, I've not had that. So I've been really lucky. I think that might be because I've got my job and done my role in that design process.
Your due diligence, if you want to call
it. I've gone through it with them. Yeah. And then you go, are you really sure you want to do that? And then you'll sketch it up and you'll send it to them and they go, that looks terrible.
Mm.
Yeah, I know. This is what you could do.
No.
It is that. But you can't. It is. You're part of a team. And you're looking after someone's hopes and expectations.
Yeah.
You're also trying to add value to the house.
Yeah.
And what you don't want to do is do something that's detrimental to them, to the house.
Yeah.
To, you know, it's a lifestyle thing. And you only do Most people only do one extension, and you've got to get it right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a luxury item.
We really are running out of time, but there's so many things I want to ask you. But so I'm going to try and get these in quickly. Is there anything that that people say, you know, look, I want to do this to the house, and you go, do you know what? That will destroy the value of the house. Yeah. You might like it, but it will make the house just not valuable.
Yeah, you do that. If it tends to be people that want to do things that are oversized and too big, and you're like, no, that. You priced yourself out of the street. You're not going to get the value out of that.
Yeah.
And when you demonstrate it to them, again, it comes back, showing them, explaining, and guiding them through. They rein it back in. So,
Right. Okay. It is a fascinating business.
It is
all
so,
of that, isn't
I could
it?
Talk and, about this forever because I love it.
And it is, our home is the most expensive thing we ever buy in our life. And it is, you know, the thing that's most precious to us outside of our kids, I guess. Yeah.
Actually, I've got a question. Have you ever built something and it's gone ahead where the client absolutely loves it and you still look at it at the end and you think that's awful?
I can't say that.
Yeah,
There is one or two in the early days when you first start out. Oh, yeah, I can do that, I can do that. And you go back and you do drive past things sometimes and you think, I wouldn't have done that now.
I'm going to pretend that wasn't me.
There are slight changes that are the in thing to do.
But at the end of the day, you know, if a client's demanded that you build something and you've designed it and had it built and the client's happy with it, what can you say? You know, what they wanted. Yeah. You've said it a few times, David. Your personal taste might not be the same as their personal taste.
The idea, I always try to meet the brief, but I always try to exceed the brief.
Yeah.
The expectation at the end.
Yeah,
so
yeah. Mm. David, if people want to find out more about NewCAD, how can they do that?
NewCAD.co.uk. I'll do that again since I was interrupted. www.newcad.co.uk or david@newcad.co.uk or 01233 640066.
Fantastic. The website details and everything are on the Kent Business Radio website, so you can also find it there. David, thank you so much for that. Really fascinating insight into architectural design and houses.
We'll do
fantastic.
Part two next month.
We'll carry on.
We're almost at the end of the show. I need to tell you about something very special that's happening on Friday with our sister show, the Business Bunker Extra Show. It's their 100th show.
Is it?
It is indeed. And they've got a 100th show special. So they've got all the co-hosts in. That'll be Ben, Richard, Gemma and Julie, I think, along with Amanda, obviously, who's presenting the show. So that's the Business Bunker Extra Show, 11 a.m. Friday for a 100th show special. This Friday, so do join in. It's Good Friday as well, isn't it? So there's no excuse. You're not at work. It's a bank holiday.
It's Easter weekend, isn't it?
You can have your hot cross buns, your cup of tea, and listen to the Business Bunker Extra Show. What's not to like? Do tune in for that here on channelradio.co.uk/2 or on bizradio.co.uk to hear the Business Bunker Extra Show. We're just about at the end of the show. I have got a quick email I need to read. Save the date. It's the annual Southeast Construction Exhibition, and the 2019 one is on Thursday, the 26th of September, and it's at the South of England Event Centre in Ardingly. You can book your place by going to constructionexpouk.co.uk. There's also, for the first time, the Construction Awards. And the awards platinum sponsor are the lovely folks at All Health Matters. So going to the same website, constructionexpouk.co.uk, you can also find out about construction awards. Oh, no, there is a special website for it, constructionexpoawards.co.uk. Find out about that and put yourself in for the awards. And just to remind you, we have played a couple of adverts for it, but ZC Live is back on the 31st of May, and the ZC social media team are super excited and have lined up an amazing agenda, and the full agenda will be revealed over the next couple of weeks. You can get your free ticket via eventbrite.co.uk/ZC Live 2019. There's a ZC Live breakfast from 8 till 9. All of this is free. And there's workshops on Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, LinkedIn and Twitter. And a couple of the speakers have been announced. There's David Pepper from Twitter and Kevin Thorpe from Big Jam Studios. But they've got loads of other speakers and the lovely Zoe Cairns as well, of course. So do get along free to that. It's at the Strood Academy on the 31st of May. And it's a fantastic event. And last year, there were about 500 people there, and I happen to know that about 400 are booked already. So do check all of that out and be there. Mm. But you know what? We've reached the end of another show.
It's gone so fast.
It does go really quickly when we have interesting people here to talk to. So my big thanks to the lovely folks from the King's School Canterbury and Mrs. Horn, their teacher, and the great folks. And I met Rosie, Jaden, and Grace from the King's School Young Enterprise Company. So fantastic.
And the fact they reached out to you, that's what I love.
Really great.
That's what I really like.
Really good stuff. Yeah. So thank you to them, and I hope you enjoyed their interview earlier. Thank you to the lovely Annette Bunn from Rift Accounting. And Annette, as always, introduced us to another fabulous guest, Mr. David Day of NUCAD. To my co-host, the lovely Bird on a Bike, Miss on a
Pleasure.
Bike. But we've reached the end of another week here on the Business Bunker Show. We'll be back next Tuesday with some more guests and some more business news. Have a fantastic Easter in between. We'll be back next week with another show. Have a great time and see you all soon. Bye, bye for now.
The Business Bunker with Paul Andrews.